Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Andy Nowicki. We're going to be talking about his new book. It's called Conspiracy, Compliance, Control, and Defiance. Andy, great having you back on.
Robert, it's always a pleasure to be on with you.
So when people see your book, they see the word conspiracy. And I guess a lot of people are kind of probably going to kind of assume it's just another conspiracy theory book that talks kind of about the usual conspiracy topics. There's like 9/11. There's the lizard theory. There's the Sandy Hook conspiracy theory. And yes, you do touch on those themes. But what this book really is about the human condition and how people are manipulated and the sort of basic human psychology and needs that lead to that manipulation.
Yes. First of all, you're right. It's not a quote unquote typical conspiracy book. I've sort of hovered on the edge of, I don't know what you call it, conspiracy theorizing or alternate explanations of various events. It's fascinated me for a long time, and I've been interested in it, and I've investigated things, and I'm not entirely sure what I think about that kind of thing. And that really, while I do touch on, questions of what's real and what isn't, what's orchestrated, to what extent we should believe the quote unquote official story or not.
So you basically, you don't endorse either the official version of things. You don't endorse any conspiracy theories either. It's just sort of an open discussion.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do have my own thoughts, my own opinions for whatever they're worth, and I think who reads the book will, who read between the lines will maybe come to certain conclusions about what they think I believe. But that's not really the focus. Like you say, the focus of the book is on the human condition, you said it very well, and about the ways in which, the various ways in which a person who strives for integrity or strives for independence of thought can be manipulated to not be independent of thought and to not have integrity in his intellectual and spiritual life. That's really the focus of the book, more than conspiracies per se.
Because basically people have their basic human needs. There's needs for food, water, oxygen, shelter, and then there's needs, you mentioned that there's needs for affirmation, praise, adulation, and status. And the latter needs are needs that you are dependent on other people, groups of people in society for those needs. But not just that, you didn't mention this, but you're also dependent on people for your economic needs as well.
Yeah, and I mean, that is a good point, though. I mean, in our day and age, really, I think maybe in any day and age, to be honest, you are taking a chance if you go outside the box and question certain bona fides that you're supposed to hold. But today, I mean, it's especially pernicious in the supposedly free Western world. Of course, if you are found to be a quote-unquote racist or a quote-unquote sexist or a quote-unquote homophobe, that can put you at risk economically as well as otherwise. So there's lots of perils to
And even those basic needs, like the need for food, that's also, you didn't mention that, but that's also a way someone could be manipulated. Not so much, especially in a dictatorship, people are dependent on, say, a dictator for food, or you can even make the case you're dependent on a corporation for food. So if you're not able to have access to your own food and water, I mean, water has been privatized in some situations. So those are also methods of controlling people by having control over food and water supply. I guess the only thing they can't control is the air, but who knows?
Right. Like in the movie Total Recall, I don't know if you've ever seen that, where air was at a premium. Yeah, but the focus in my book is not so much on those basic human needs, those needs that, you know, everybody has just to survive at all. But I guess if you go up the, you know, the Maslow's hierarchy, this social psychologist who had this hierarchy of needs theorizing that he did, you go a little bit higher, and there's a need not just to survive, but also to feel proud of oneself. And pride for some people is, unfortunately, to a large degree, determined on getting praise from others. And so those who with more, I guess, more of a need to feel integrity, or a need to feel that, you know, their pride isn't just cheaply bought, but is authentic, they're the ones who are really put at a disadvantage, because they still have this need to be affirmed, like I'm saying, but there's also this need to, I don't know, feel like you're better than that, to feel like you can make it without the affirmation of others. And so that can be a real vulnerability, and that's part of the I guess what motivated me to write this book.
Would you say that you're completely independent of that need for affirmation, or would you be lying if you said you were?
Oh, I'd be lying if I said I was, and that was really the struggle that I and people like me, I think maybe others who read the book, others who maybe are interested in the book, will find themselves in the same boat. That's what we struggle with. The need, the pride in itself is kind of a need to feel like you can get along without people praising you, and you don't just want to say things that are going to make you popular. You know, you want to tell the truth, and the truth often makes you unpopular, and so that's the struggle. You know, that your pride pushes you, and pride can be good or bad. In a sense, it's good in that it can push you to have a certain integrity or desire for, as I was saying, intellectual independence, and to stake out truth where you see it, whether or not it's what you're supposed to believe in. And on the other hand, pride can be a weakness, because it can make you really need affirmation. There's a vulnerability to it that can be manipulated very easily.
One thing that is interesting from a theological perspective is pride is considered a sinful in Christianity, I think especially Catholicism, but I'm not really sure if that's the case in other religions. Maybe that's unique to Christianity.
Well, it's pride in a certain sense. I mean, and we have to be careful how we define our terms, of course. You know, pride is sinful in the Christian sense when we talk about trying to be really wanting to be gods in ourselves, wanting to it doesn't just mean, I mean, there's a sense of pride that can be, I mean, every word has various definitions. And there's a sense in which, you know, pride is not a sinful thing. It can be, you know, a positive thing, and it can be the mark of, again, a person who has, properly speaking, ambition to be, to have integrity, not to just fall in line with whatever everybody else is thinking, which is something that, as a Christian, you want to cultivate in others. But pride is the downfall, is our downfall, when we want to replace God. We want to think of ourselves in some way that we should only think of God as being, and where, of course, Christians believe that ultimately we're not saved by anything except the divine. And so there's a place for humility and for a sense in which the one can only enter the kingdom of heaven through having a humble heart. And it's all part of, you know, all these different definitions of pride, these different notions of pride. You know, they all kind of intersect in my book, and it's somewhat complicated, but hopefully it's worth sorting through.
It's also, there's pride based on sort of more materialistic values, but there's also people who take pride on feeling morally or spiritually superior to other people.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's people take pride in different things. I mean, you've got your standard sort of, I guess there's what you were calling materialistic pride, which is the sort of being able to lord it over others, or being able to think, well, I make X amount of money and this other person only makes Y amount of money, so therefore I win, he loses. Or, you know, I drive a better car than this person, or my wife is better looking than this other guy's wife, or whatever. All those kinds of things in which people compete against other people. That's one side of it. And then there's, you know, other more complicated and really multifarious, multidimensional aspects of pride, where one can paradoxically feel pride in supposing himself to be more humble than someone else. That's where things get really complicated.
And then you also have envy, which is also viewed as sinful by a lot of Christian teachings. The thing with envy is envy can do two things. Envy can keep a person manipulated and controlled. Like, it makes a person in envy feel that they have to do this and this to achieve this or to be accepted. Envy could cause people to strive to fight for justice in some situations too. So envy by itself,
right,
I don't see it as inherently bad. It just, it depends what it's put towards to, what it's used for.
Well, envy is the sin, one of the deadly sins. I was told once that envy is the deadly sin where there's no pleasure that can be derived from it. If you envy somebody else, really you're only in pain thinking about what this other person has that you don't have. Whereas every other sin, there's some kind of pleasure attached to it. And so envy kind of can inspire pride in a sense that, you know, if you are envious of what others have and what you don't have, that can push you along to try to be, you know, to be competitive and to try to outdo them in some way or other. But in the book, in my new book, again, I use that all as a starting point. In a way, this book is a very personal book, although I don't really talk that much about myself directly, but I have a very direct association with the subject matter, in that I start from the perspective of, here is someone struggling in the world for integrity, for intellectual integrity, let's say, and independence of thought, as I've said before, and for, you know, just for the truth, for the capacity to adhere to the truth to the end. And yet the world is always, there are always snares in the world, and particularly in our age, in our society, there are certain, and probably this has always been the case, but there are today definitely certain powerfully placed people who are out to, they're basically out for power, for control, and they're going to do what it takes to get it and to keep it and to enhance it. And so in a way, it's, you know, if you're striving for independence, it's you against them, and you are basically outgunned and outnumbered.
You have the exploiters, and then you have the people who are exploited, And then you have the people who challenge them and rebel, but then you have some people who just, like, drop out.
Mm-hmm. Sums it up. And I think in my book I'm concerned with fighting, because I do think that there is, you know, that famous quote from Hemingway that I remember best from the movie Seven, at the end, that Morgan Freeman says that the world is a fine Morgan Freeman's character says that Ernest Hemingway said the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part. You know, that's kind of I've always liked that quote, and that's you know, more or less what I, it's sort of a meta quote. It's a quote of a quote, and that's it in a nutshell.
So this brings us to the topic of conspiracy theories, and I think conspiracy theories are, people are how people get to conspiracy theories is people are always trying to analyze, like, how the world works, and conspiracy theories are definitely, they're sort of based on this, how some people manipulate other people, how they manipulate society. But one thing I've noticed about conspiracy theories is they want to sort of, their view of the world is sort of like, they view the world as if it's a movie. Like, you have these villains, and it's a very sort of a sort of plot-driven, film-driven way of looking at the world.
I guess it can be. I mean, it can be a overly simplistic perspective, and I think some people that will be so. But I think it can also be the truth that there are varying levels to things. That is to say, on one level, you know, yes, we are free agents. We have our own. We can forge our way in the world, and you know, for most of us, the governments, the powers that be, probably aren't that interested in us. So, you know, they're probably not listening to this conversation right now, just because it probably doesn't concern them. That, you know, I don't think that I'm high on the list of people who concern them or who interest them. So, on the one hand, yes, there are some people who propose conspiracy theories might have this reductionist or simplistic or overly dramatic, as you say, plot-driven kind of perspective, where life is a movie and there are good guys and bad guys and nothing in the middle. But I definitely don't see things like that. I don't see things like that personally, and I also see that, you know, the two can coexist. There can be powerful people who do terrible things and get away with it and are interested in framing the conversation a particular way or manipulating people to feel a certain way for a certain nefarious ends. That can be true. And at the same time, on another level, you know, there could be chaos, and the powers that be might not have as much control as they think they have, and they might. And this is a point that I make in the book as well, when I'm talking about the reptilians, as I call them, which I should say, you know, with apologies to David Icke and others who subscribe to
the secret that David Icke is a lot of. I don't know if he literally believes it, but a lot of his fans actually literally believe in this reptilian theory. But
right.
Use it more. It could be seen as kind of an analogy, like these people they're talking about are very kind of cold-blooded, ruthless, sociopathic. That's one way to look at it, as an analogy.
My impression is that David Icke, at least as he talks about it, that he truly believes it, or that it's, I mean, I don't know, we never know what's in somebody else's head, of course, but my understanding of his perspective on things as he espouses them to others seems to be that the reptilians are literally reptilians. And in my case, in my book, when I talk about reptilians, literally of a different DNA, that these are shapeshifters from a different dimension, literally. you know, with a different DNA than we are, like in the miniseries V from the 80s. I don't know if you've ever seen that. And others, you know, there's actually a lot of lizard people kind of lore out there. It's kind of interesting. But for me, when I talk about the reptilians in my book, I'm talking about the kind of people who tend to ascend to the top, who tend to become the rulers, and they are different from the rest of us in certain crucial ways that, you know, that mark them as different in a very sinister way, but still, I would say a generally metaphorical way. Not you know, who knows for sure, but I find it dubious to say that they're to think that they're actually of a different DNA or that they're a different species than the rest of us. But they, metaphorically speaking, are, I think, quite different from the rest of us. You know, so startlingly different that we might as well view them as a different species.
Do you think describing them all as like a sociopathic, do you think that's too simplistic, like getting into sort of like a pop psychology territory?
Well, that's, you know, when you bring up pop psychology and sociopathy, yeah, that's, I'm glad you brought that up, because there is a lot of, I mean, people talk about sociopaths a lot these days, and there seems to be this fascination with sociopathy that, oh, I don't remember what percentage, this is it something like 5% of the human race are sociopaths, and, you know, books are written about, oh, the sociopath next door, or are you dating a sociopath, or are you a sociopath, all these kinds of, you know, these questionnaires that you can take that are supposedly going to determine the level of sociopathy. And in my book, I actually differentiate between sociopathy, whatever value we can put on the notion of sociopathy. I mean, I think there are such people as sociopaths, even if it's kind of an overblown concept these days. But in my book, I differentiate between the sociopath and the reptilian in some really crucial ways. And I talk about this in an excerpt from the book that I've put at Alternative Right, Our Reptilian Rulers is the name of it. And there's also an Our Reptilian Rulers Part 2, where I excerpt these parts of the book. But I differentiate between the sociopath and the reptilian, because a sociopath, as commonly understood, isn't really a malevolent person, even though a person who has no conscience and can sort of, you know, is sort of okay with doing whatever he feels like doing, and that's not what we would think of as a good way to be. But I think, generally speaking, your standard sociopath is just sort of drifting through life, looking for thrills, you know, taking up with this kind of scam or I don't know, way of life for a little while, and then getting bored with it and moving on to something else. And I don't think he really necessarily wants to hurt other people. He doesn't care if he hurts them, but he doesn't really care that much. He's just sort of, I think the typical sociopath is not terribly ambitious. And the differentiation that I make between the sociopath and the type of person that I call a reptilian is that a reptilian is intensely ambitious and intensely malevolent, in the sense that he has this hunger for the power that comes of hurting others, and not just ruling them, but terrorizing them. And, you know, he gets off on that. And so I think that I talk about the reptilian as sort of the sociopath who has done well, in the sense that, you know, a sociopath is more of a drifter or a grifter, somebody who just goes through life and does what he feels like doing, but isn't terribly ambitious and, you know, doesn't amount to much. Whereas a reptilian, got ambition, he's got drive, he wants to conquer, darn it, and he's gonna take whatever he can get.
So you talk about 9/11 in this book, and depending on whether you believe in the conspiracy theory or the official version, 9/11 definitely deals with a lot of the themes.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you believe that 9/11 was an inside job, there's these individuals, like, regardless of who you believe was behind it, some people think it was George Bush. Some people, there's just different theories, and there's that theory involves manipulation and all that. But if you believe in the mainstream version, then the 9/11 hijackers were manipulated into doing that. Like, they were, basically, if you look at the 9/11 hijackers, a lot of them were men who felt powerless, and they were promised, sort of a martyrdom and fame, and they were promised, like, the 72 virgins in the afterlife.
Right.
So
right.
9/11, regardless of what stance you take, ties into all these themes.
Yeah. And the point that I make in the book, when I talk about 9/11 and also Sandy Hook and just in general this perspective where, you know, with these particular events, these major events, that these tragedies, these catastrophes, my perspective on them, you know, I don't take a stand one way or the other about whether the official story or one of the alternative theories is true. Like I said, I have my own beliefs, and I think if you read, you can pretty much come to see or to suspect what I think. But I don't. That's not the focus. The focus is whether or not these events were real or manipulated, or, you know, whether it was completely unexpected or totally an inside job or a false flag or whatever you want to call it. Regardless, we certainly have people people in power who exploited them to the hilt. And, you know, maybe it was just something that came around and they said, oh, well, this has happened now. We anticipated something like this maybe happening. So let's put forth our various ways of exploiting the masses. Let's see what let's, you know, use this as an occasion to basically perform these kind of psychological tests to see what.
And it was very, very effective. Right after 9/11, people were so emotional and sort of caught up in a hysteria that they were willing to go along with a lot of the policies that were being promoted and manipulation.
Yeah. It was trauma. I mean, it was people talk about trauma-based mind control. And in a way, that was what 9/11 was. Because whether you were there, I mean, I'm sure for the people who were actually there, who survived, in New York or saw it, or who barely escaped or whatever, for them it was a very direct trauma. But for the rest of the nation, and to a degree the rest of the world, it was also traumatic, because it was this sudden thing where it felt like the world was ending, and it felt like people, they were going to get us wherever we were, and there was no way to hide and nowhere to go, and so there was a degree of a feeling of powerlessness, and so from that, of course, we.
When people feel in danger, they're going to want to look to a protector. So
yeah.
they felt threatened by terrorism. So a lot of people felt that the government was out there. They looked to the government as a protector.
Yeah.
And then conspiracy theorists responded to that by saying that basically, like, everything the government says is lies. So I think it's good to find a good sort of a nuanced balance of looking at things, not jumping to sort of one extreme or the other.
Right. And the more things change, the more they stay the same. I mean, there's nothing in my book about ISIS, about what happened, what all happened this past year with ISIS, with the attacks in Paris and San Bernardino, and that, you know, it's all of a sudden we're all on alert again, even though there hasn't been anything quite like 9/11 that's happened again. But there's, it's, in a way, you know, it never changed. It never, it's always been around. And it corresponds, of course, with, I think, something in the human psyche that, you know, we react this way to perceptions of danger. And there's something about the whole idea that all of a sudden, you know, we could just be walking around minding our own business and suddenly some guys might jump out of nowhere and start shooting us. I mean, that's what happened in Paris, apparently. And, you know, and with 9/11, it was, we're just going through a normal day and all of a sudden, you know, there's planes crashing into buildings, buildings on fire, buildings falling down that were once these indomitable figures, you know, that destroyed the world like a colossus. Suddenly they're just gone. You know, they're just dust. They don't exist. They're, you know, it was mind boggling. And there was definitely a sense in which it was all exploited to the hilt. Whether it was an inside job or not, it was certainly the people on high made use of it to manipulate us.
And the other event you talked about is Sandy Hook. So, like 9/11, you don't really endorse the conspiracy theory either. But one thing I will say about like a lot of these events is, like, I remember when Columbine happened, and you're known for that book, Columbine Pilgrim. That was a really shocking event. But I think the more stuff like this happens, the more people become desensitized to it. It has less of a psychological effect. I noticed that especially older people are more shocked by these events. But I think younger people who grew up they grew up with events like Columbine and 9/11, where maybe young kids when that happened, they're more desensitized to it. And if you turn on the news, it's constantly about terrorism and shootings. So there's a desensification. Yeah. And in some ways, desensification makes different cases for it, but one argument, it can make people less likely to be manipulated. But it could also make people less likely to want to take action. It could turn people kind of, I guess it makes people kind of either ambivalent or even kind of nihilistic.
Yeah, well, I mean, and people said that about, what's interesting is people said that about my generation when we were younger as well, Generation X, you know, when we were all in our 20s, it was said that we, you know, we were desensitized or jaded, or, you know, we just sort of said whatever and went about our business and weren't really affected by things in the same way that previous generations were. And it seems like that's what they're saying about you millennials now. It's interesting. There's that parallel. But there's being jaded in, you know, like, oh, this happened on the news, or look at what happened in this part of the world or that part of the world. That's terrible, but I don't feel anything. I mean, there's that, and then, you know, there's, if something actually happens to you or to people that you know and you're still jaded, then that's another level of jadedness. And I don't know to what extent two are related, because we all have to have some degree of, you know, compartmentalization. It's otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be able to make it through the day. Because there are terrible things happening all over the world all the time, and there's, you know, tons of people die every single day, but you don't go through every single day thinking about death. So there's a certain amount of compartmentalization that's I think healthy. It doesn't mean you don't care. It doesn't mean you're not properly sensitive. It doesn't mean you're a sociopath, like we were talking about before.
I guess before the media, people would have direct experience to death or to warfare. But in a sense, people's exposure to violence and death is for the media, so that also desensitizes people if they haven't had any personal interactions with it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the whole question, the chicken egg question. You know, do people playing violent video games or watching Quentin Tarantino movies and so forth, does that have some sort of negative effect? Does that make people less sensitive than they should be to actual, you know, terror that happens in the world? I've never found that particularly to be the case with me, just speaking personally. You know, I've found that I'm affected by certain things. It's always unexpected when it happens. I guess it's not always unexpected, but it often is. I don't think that the entertainment that I've consumed or what I've seen in the news, I don't feel like there's much of a causal relationship. I feel like there's something deep inside of you that is just a primal, that just reacts primally. And I've had that kind of reaction, that kind of response to things. And, you know, that's just, I don't know. Now that can be used, that can be exploited, of course. But I don't know whether we're being degraded by by being exposed to certain things in the press or in movies or TV shows or not. I don't really have as strong an opinion on that as I think some others might.
With the Sandy Hook massacre, what do you get into about that case? Do you have sort of basically the similar themes that you say about 9/11?
Yeah, well, I don't really go into it as much, but what I do talk about is, again, the way in which it was used. And I think the really nefarious ways in which it was exploited to shame people or to try there was like, I remember after Sandy Hook, I just didn't watch the news for weeks and weeks because it was the same. It was what somebody described as grief porn, just over and over and over again. And, you know, there was that, there was the grief porn, there was this sort of really obscene kind of pushing your nose in it, making you revel in the grief.
With the gun control debate, they sort of, it's a guilt trip tactic that they say
yes.
People who disagree with their views on gun control are somehow, they have a complacency in the murders.
Yeah. The indictment of gun owners, the indictment of, you know, normal people who own guns, who've never done anything, would never dream of doing anything like what supposedly happened at Sandy Hook. That was, you know, extremely excruciatingly disingenuous and very hard to take. So there's basically no good that came of it. Let me put it this way. It was exploited in all manner of ways that I think were really nefarious and just plain rotten. It bothers me even more than 9/11, that how 9/11 was exploited for some reason. In some ways, it just seemed even more shameless.
Well, with Sandy Hook, is the perpetrator Adam Lanza, he basically had no explicit like manifesto or motive. The 9/11 hijackers obviously did, but a lot of shooters do.
Right. Right. Yeah,
and
no,
you
and that's
touch
what
on,
I
you actually touch on Adam Lanza briefly. You don't get into him that much, but you kind of talk about his profile. You just kind of describe him as like being like nerdy and semi-autistic.
Yeah, he's this, and that's the thing. You know, some things are exploited like 9/11, where it's just in your face. Look at these explosions. Look at these buildings collapsing. Look at these people jumping to their deaths. That was very, very in your face, very visual. What's notable about Sandy Hook, and people have come to different conclusions about this, and again, this is not the focus of what I'm writing about in the book, but there is very little visual about this event. There's nothing that ever emerged. We never saw Adam Lanza enter the school. We never see any of the shooting take place. But none of the, supposedly it was never filmed, even though they had this security apparatus at the school. We never saw bodies, never saw blood. And to me, it was like just talking about the exploitative version of it. It's almost the other end of the spectrum is 9/11. 9/11, they're showing you, it's like this grindhouse kind of thing where they're like this snuff film, you know, they're making you watch this and traumatizing you in that way. With Sandy Hook, it's like, think of something so unimaginable, like, you know, somebody just shooting a bunch of little kids, innocent, beautiful little kids, for no reason at all. And, you know, and somehow just the lack of visuality was in its way exploitive. And Adam Lanza, the only picture we ever have of him is this weird low res picture of, you know, the spooky looking young man, with this chalky white complexion. And that's all we have. I mean, that's all we've got. And there's no, like you said, there's no manifesto. There's no, not much of a history that we even have. And so somehow, and again, I'm not taking a position on anything regarding the real versus false flag notion, but somehow that was all used, I think, in a way to manipulate us in the other direction, because there's something really scary about what we can see, you know, in excruciating detail. And there's also something really frightening and horrifying and, you know, terrifying, terror-inducing about what we cannot see.
And I would even say that about horror films, like the most effective horror films are the ones where they're psychological, where there's something mysterious. Sometimes in a horror film where they show everything in gruesome detail, that kind of takes away from that.
Yeah, less is more, like they say. And I do think so. There's some things where what you don't see or what's just hinted at and can really haunt your dreams forever.
That's true with religion, because like religion uses the fear of hell, and that's not somewhere that like people have actually seen. Like the unknown is the most disturbing to people, as opposed to something they can like visually see.
Well, that might be true. Although if you've ever read Dante, I mean, it's pretty darn visual there. I mean, it's pretty detailed.
But the thing about that is that's not from actually the Bible. That was written,
right?
I guess, I don't know if you want to call it, it was written as a fictional novel, but later a lot during that era, the Catholic Church put it out and a lot of people get literally, it's sort of basically like the modern day concept of hell is based on that novel.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was hugely influential. Yeah. Yeah. And it was Dante using his imagination, and not just for hell, although that's the one that's most read, I guess, cause it's the most badass or whatever. But he also wrote about purgatory and he wrote about heaven. And for all of those, you know, highly imaginative, highly detailed. So, yeah, there can be a power in, I mean, the senses are powerful. We perceive the world through our senses. And when something affects us in a particular way, it affects us through our senses. But on the other hand, there's a way in which we can be affected in a non-sensory or asensory or extrasensory kind of way as well, that a sixth sense, you know, kind of way that can creep in there. And, you know, that's also part of our perception.
So you also go into the theme of sexuality and how sex is used as a way to manipulate people. And
yes.
You talk about a pornographic culture and the effects that has on people. There's a lot of...
Right.
It's kind of like the cliche sex sells. A lot of people base their decisions in life on their sexual desires.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, it's... You know, it can be you know, there's the honeypot or the honey trap that's talked about in when it comes to spies and that whole culture or not just pertaining to spies, but anything pertaining to manipulation. Or even if it's just even if there's nothing about manipulating beyond just trying to get money out of someone.
Back to the conspiracy theory angle, like one conspiracy is that people who have some kind of hidden sexual vice are recruited
right.
for positions of power because they can easily be blackmailed.
Oh, yeah. And blackmail is probably I think it plays a huge role. This is just my theory. I think it plays a huge role in what goes on among the corridors of power. And I suspect that it has something to do with Bill Cosby's sudden fall from grace. I don't think there's any way that people didn't know what Cosby, if he really did these things to women, there's no way people didn't know about it in Hollywood and elsewhere. In the 70s and 80s and 90s, but for some reason now it's, you know, this is the time in which for whatever reason, you know, he's got to take the fall, and maybe it has something to do with, you know, somebody being blackmailed or with him suddenly, you know, not playing ball in one way or another. It's all, you know, I'm just using him as an example, but I suspect that is the case with many people. And what I was going to say a minute ago was, you know, even something low level as Facebook. I mean, we're both on Facebook, and I don't know about you, but I get tons of Facebook requests from, you know, big-breasted women in bikinis that I don't know from Adam. You know, they suddenly pop up.
They usually have like one mutual friend in common.
Yeah, one mutual friend at most. I wonder sometimes if it isn't, you know, somebody sent to try to get me to do something, you know, to try to lead me into temptation. Or it could just be, I don't know, somebody with a sex line service who...
There's a scam they do on Facebook where they have these like cam whores that target guys on Facebook, and then when they agree to that, they actually get like footage of them like jerking off over their webcam, and then they blackmail them with the footage and say,
yeah,
like, pay this amount of money or we're going to put the footage of you doing that act online.
I have no doubt that that's the case. And I've had, you know, I pretty much friend whoever wants to friend me because there's nothing I share on Facebook that I'm not okay with the world knowing. I mean, I don't tell any of my secrets there or anything. But I've friended people and then have suddenly had to try to want to chat with me. And, you know, I'm always very wary, you know, when it's so open-ended, like they say, hello. And I'm just supposed to, you know, how are you? You know, so there's that. But then I kind of wonder about there being some more sophisticated kinds of scams out there, possibly, you know, where, you know, maybe they're, who knows? I mean, this where you know, it can lead into really some paranoid kinds of directions, because you don't really know who, especially if you're somebody in the, you know, who is, again, going against the grain, espousing positions for which people are losing their jobs, really taking on frowned upon beliefs, and really fighting the zeitgeist, you never really know who might be out there seeming to be your friend, seeming to be your fan, seeming to be on your side, but might be, not what he or she seems to be. And that's all part of the whole dimension of what we're talking about right now.
So you give an example of like a man that you have in mind who's lonely, isolated, and an alienated soul, and you ask him if he may well glare at you with simmering impatience, dubious of your sincerity in inquiring, and he's correct
right.
to be suspicious.
Yeah, well, I mean, I try to, that's really what it, like I said, that this whole book, it's like there's an aspect to it that's very, looking out at the world, trying to make sense of things. But there's also an aspect of it that's very, very personal, that's motivated by personal, motivated by personal concerns. And there is that, it is ultimately about this particular kind of person who has this attitude, has this perspective, feels generally alienated from the world, feels that the truth is not of the world, and wants to go deeper and find it, dig for it, and so forth.
You're saying with this person, is their response would come across as kind of a gruff and unfriendly, and people just take that response. They basically see it as just being rude. But the point you make is that empathy requires understanding, and empathy really people can try to have empathy, but when it comes down to it, some people are very empathetic. But for most people, empathy comes from their empathy is towards people who have similar experiences as they do.
Yeah, sure. That's fair to say. And like I said before, it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you if you are, if you're more comfortable with people of your own kind who share your concerns and who remind you in some way of yourself, or who are, related to you family-wise, or who are close friends of yours. That doesn't mean that you're a sociopath, or that you cannot, feel empathy for anyone else outside of your immediate circle. But it does. I guess that what I'm talking about there in that part of the book about empathy requiring understanding is I do think that if you approach somebody who is this kind of person, and just sort of like, I've had people come up to me and say, hey, what you reading? If I'm reading a book that I'm sure they don't know anything about, they don't know the author, they don't really care that much. They're just sort of asking a question to ask a question. Or just any kind of overture where, they're inquiring, but there's not really that much interest behind their inquiry. That's the sort of thing that I think some people could come to realize that can be annoying. And that's just the point that I'm making there, that, if you could understand this person and understand his struggles, you would maybe see why just approaching him with this kind of idle chatter, chit-chatter, these questions, where you ask him an open-ended question, you're not terribly interested in the answer.
You go on to talk about this hypothetical individual. You talk about his humiliation, his vulnerability, his unfortunate but necessary byproduct of his existential authenticity. But you also go on to a point that that this individual is also vulnerable to being manipulated.
Right. Oh yeah. Yes. And that's just the thing. You know, we all want to belong and we all want to feel like we're understood. And, you know, it's not just about wanting sex. It's not just about, you know, base drives necessarily. It, you know, the honeypot thing, the you know, somebody, some woman trying to contact you on Facebook or some other social media, you know, on one level might just be about trying to get you to jerk off to their naked pictures or whatever, to their dirty talk. It might be something much more than that. It might be, wow, I found someone who understands me, and you know, what a blessing, you know, somebody that can win your heart and just make it gets you to again to let down your guard because you think that this is real. This is a real and authentic thing. But boy, that can be, I imagine that can be easily exploited. This desire to belong, this desire to find someone, you know.
Also, like a terrorist organization, they sometimes might look out for those kind of individuals to try to recruit them.
Oh yeah, yeah. They would look out for somebody who's vulnerable, who feels a need to be a part of something. I mean, that's the human condition, I think, in a lot of ways. That's what we all want.
And you even give like social media as an example of that. A lot of
right.
people are on social media. They like check their Facebook profile every day to see like how many likes that their post got. I was
right.
reading in some news article. There's some competition in middle schools where they actually like in middle schools are developing like a social hierarchy based on who gets like the most Facebook likes on their profiles.
Yeah, I mean that's I groan a little bit to hear that, or it makes me sad to hear that. But that's not really hasn't really changed that much since when I was in middle school. I mean that's the same. It's born of the same kind of desires. It was just when I was that age, there was no internet, so you know it was other things that were used to, you know, for the popularity game, to measure who was higher on the hierarchy than others.
Towards the end of the book, you actually sort of continue talking about this hypothetical individual. You go on about the theme of this person, a feeling of being a tormented.
Which person being a tormentor? Can you explain, can you give me the context there?
You were telling a story about some hypothetical person, and
uh-huh.
you're talking about how they continue to go for the stage of being more and more psychologically tormented.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. Well, just tormented by all the desires that, you know, all the things that make us needy, all the things that make us, that make this particular person, you know, that torment him because he has this pride and he wants to not be manipulated, not be, he wants not to want the things that he wants. I mean, that's the best way I can think of putting it. And he's tormented by the fact that he does. No matter what he does, he still wants the things that he wants, which is status, you know, affirmation, and so forth. That's the extent to which he's tormented, and it ultimately culminates with the question: is there something that can be done? Can a person do something to himself to finally render himself invulnerable to
Well, I
these.
Guess that's kind of why, if you look at the lifestyle of a Catholic monk, they completely isolate themselves from society. They give up all their material possessions. They practice celibacy. I guess that's what they're
right.
trying. That's what they're trying to achieve. But it's something that is, it's for a lot of people, it's like unfathomable.
Oh yeah, sure. This may not be the something that absolutely everyone can relate to. You know, this despising oneself for one's neediness, and you know, despising oneself for liking to go to his Facebook page and enjoying seeing some post of his getting a bunch of likes. You know, I guess for some people it's just sort of they don't really think about it. They just think, oh, look, I got all these likes, isn't that great, and leave it at that. And, but for other people, it's sort of like, oh yeah, I got all these likes and I like that. Oh, you know, why do I like that? It shouldn't matter. And it goes on from there. Depends on how you are, I guess, the kind of person you are.
So your last chapter is titled The Final Solution.
Yes.
So what is your final solution?
Well, in that final chapter, not to give it all away, but that's where I, because I do want people to buy it, of course, and read it, but that final chapter is where I get into the whole question of is there, you know, if something can be plucked out by the root and it is no more, you know, if you find a plant, pull it out by its root, then that plant is dead and it's not going to grow in the soil anymore. Is there a way to find the root of this thing that makes you desire these things, makes you covetous of these qualities? You know, is there a way to do that, to reach down and to pluck it out so that it's gone? And I cite the interesting, fairly radical, I use the word radical advisedly because I'm talking about root, part of the quote from the Bible where Jesus says, if your eye offends you or if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. To enter heaven with one eye, than to be led into perdition. Speaks of other body parts as well. You know, if your arm causes you to sin, cut it off. And this is mostly taken as hyperbole or metaphorical language, but it's still very, you know, it definitely makes the reader stand up and take notice. And so that's the quote that I consider at the very end with regard to this whole matter of whether or not it's possible to overcome oneself, to overcome one's neediness.
Before I wrap up the show, is there anything else, any other topics in the book that I didn't get a chance to touch upon?
No, I think we've covered pretty much everything. I just want to say that it's, again, the title is Conspiracy. Actually, I keep forgetting the title. It's four words: conspiracy, compliance, control, and defiance. Conspiracy, compliance, control, and defiance. And it's available now both in paperback and on Kindle. When I wrote the post at Alternative Right, it was only out in paperback at the time, but now it's out on Kindle as well. And so you can find it online or at Amazon.com and probably some other sites as well.
What have been some of the responses that you have gotten so far?
Well, I haven't heard that much so far because it was only released a few days ago. So I know this is kind of a departure for me in some ways because I've written a lot of fiction lately, and this is not fiction. And what I've written that hasn't been fiction has been more memoir oriented, Confessions of a Would-Be Wanker and Notes Before Death. Those were both, you know, about my youth and my reflections on certain aspects of my youth. And so this is a bit different. This is a nonfiction work that's, if it's like anything I've written before, it's sort of like the second part of my very first book, Considering Suicide. which is titled "Is Life Worth Living?" In that it's a non-fictional philosophical investigation, exploration, you know, consideration of what's going on in the world right now and what it has to say about the human condition and, you know, what can be done. That's the other thing. The subtitle of it is a primer on what is and what is to be done. That's the latest book. That's the subtitle, which is sort of a little bit of a bit ambiguous or a little bit of an ambitious way of phrasing it. But you know, I approach these issues again in a personal kind of way. It's motivated by the personal, but it's different from other things that I've written lately in that it's a bit more expansive.
Andy Nowicki, it's been a great show. Thanks for being on.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always fun.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.